on retreat, particularly in the first days of a retreat, and on a short retreat like this one. Often the first few days of a retreat are dealing with that momentum I talked about early on in the retreat. All of the movement of mind that when we stop, we see this continuation of our life. And so we stop, we sit down, and we get to observe what's going on in our minds. Often it's not pleasant. Often what's going on in our minds reflects a lot of what we've been dealing with in our life, a lot of wanting things, wanting to get rid of things, planning about things. So there's a lot of movement of this kind of difficult energy that we really begin to see very clearly when we stop and sit down and begin to pay attention. Often we think it's a mistake that we're seeing these things. We're instructed to start by paying attention to the breath, and somehow we feel like, at least I know I felt like in my first few retreats, this is supposed to stop the mind. But really a lot of what this does, what this practice does, where we try to come back to the breath, where we try to bring our attention into the present moment, a lot of what it does is highlights how difficult it is to stay in the present moment. We get to see we're pulled out to this and moved out to that. Our mind's just going this way and that way. And during the day today, we've been talking about opening up to all of these things, all of these difficult things that come up, emotions, thoughts, so that we're not having to be just tied to the breath, but it's not just about being with the breath. Really, what this practice is about is opening to all of our experience, including and especially the difficulties that we encounter. One of the main teachings of the Buddha is the Four Noble Truths. And the first noble truth is the truth of suffering. I'm sure you're all familiar with this after today, that we suffer. When we stop, we notice, actually, how much we suffer. What the Buddha said we needed to do with this suffering, he didn't just put it out there and say, you know, this is a truth, believe me. He said we should act on this truth by working to understand suffering. And this understanding that he talks about is not an intellectual understanding. It's not thinking about it. That's how we normally think about understanding things in our culture. We think about the why of things, as Pam spoke about. Why is this happening? And we get lost in stories or thoughts thinking about the why. The understanding that the Buddha was talking about has more to do with looking at what's actually happening in the present moment. What are we actually experiencing? So this understanding of suffering has to do with coming into the present moment and looking at what is actually happening. There's a list of five particularly difficult states of mind that we work with in meditation practice. The Buddha was he loved making lists. I think partly because of the way the tradition was carried forward in a oral tradition, it's easier to remember things when they're in lists like this. So he had lists for everything. And he had this list of five qualities that are difficult states of mind that we work with in meditation. The Pali term for it is Nivarana. And it means, that the term means covering. So it's states of mind that cover over a more settled or open state of mind. Often the translation for this term is called the hindrances. And I can kind of see the term, because in many ways the Buddha talked about these states as those states that get in the way of concentration. So you can think of them as states that hinder concentration. But in my experience, in my own practice, I've discovered that they're only hindrances as long as they're not seen. So these states are sensual desire, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and doubt. If these states are operating in our experience but not seen in our experience, they do hinder our concentration. But when they are seen, they're no longer hindrances. They're no longer in the way of our practice. So often when we confront these states in our practice, we think, this is not good. I need to get rid of this desire. I need to find out how to work with this so that it will go away. I need to get rid of this ill will, this aversion that I'm experiencing. We so often have that feeling that that's what we're supposed to do. Is these things are hindrances, after all. We're supposed to get them out of the way so they're no longer hindering our practice. But they, as I mentioned, they're only hindrances as long as they're not observed. As soon as they come into the light of mindfulness, they become our path. They become the way towards the ending of suffering. So this is the understanding of suffering. When we experience these states, and they're often experienced as unpleasant, difficult states of mind. Sometimes they get so strong that we're, just kind of out of our experience altogether. When we can bring our attention to them with mindfulness, they begin to reveal themselves for what they are, which is just these coverings. They're visitors. They are not who we are. So often with these states of mind, we really identify with them. We really believe they are us. They define us. In so many ways, we feel that, I'm a really, angry person, or I'm a really greedy person. We have these identifications around many of these states. But they're just states of mind that come together because causes and conditions come together, and they pass when those causes and conditions are no longer in place. So they're simply visitors. They really are just states of mind that come and go. And with our mindfulness, we can really start to see that truth, the truth that they are impermanent, and they are not they do not define us. They do not define who we are. So understanding something in terms of our practice, again, I don't mean understanding intellectually. I mean understanding in a nonverbal, non-conceptual way. There's several ways that we can go about understanding our experience. we can start to observe it and notice what essentially causes it. So what are the conditions that make it appear? We can learn to cultivate qualities of mind that oppose it. We can also learn to understand the skillfulness or unskillfulness of the state of mind. Now, with the hindrances, this can be challenging. The hindrances are typically, at least when they're not observed, when hindrances are not observed, they're unskillful states of mind. When they're not seen clearly with mindfulness, they're unskillful states of mind. But it can be difficult to really see this and believe it. So, for instance, if we're in a state of desire, it's hard to really believe that it's unskillful to try to get this thing, because we know we'll be happy when we get it. I mean, it feels like the natural course of things, that if we satisfy our desires, we're happy. And so the desire itself doesn't seem to be unskillful, because we know that we'll be happier if we get that thing. So it's hard to see these. It's hard to see as an unskillful mind state, this desire. And likewise with something like a worry, you know, the state of agitated mind worrying about something. There's this pull of the mind to really say, I've got to figure this out. It's really important that I worry about this thing, because I know that something's going to happen if I don't worry about it. So it's hard to actually see these things as unskillful mind states when we're caught in them. So a lot of what I'm going to talk about this evening is each of these five kinds of difficult mind states, and talk a little bit about how to work with them, how to begin to understand these states of mind in our experience. So, sensual desire. Sensual desire has to do with this, with a being attached to what we like, with what we like to have around us. To, you know, putting ourselves in comfortable situations, the food we like. Not so much that it's a bad thing to have those things, but that we get attached to having it a certain way. So the sensual desire is about the attachment to wanting things to be a certain way. So it's not necessarily a problem to have things around us that make us happy, that make us feel good, that we like to be in contact with. People that we like to be with. That's not a problem. The problem is we think that that is the only way that we can be happy. We've learned through so much of our experience that when we have a desire, if we satisfy that desire, that we're happy. When we get what we want, we're happy. And we think that that's the only way that we can be happy. That's how we've been trained, essentially. That the satisfaction of our desires is what makes us happy. I think one of the brilliant things that the Buddha pointed out that we can see in our own experience is that it's not the satisfaction of the desire that really brings the happiness, although it certainly brings a moment of happiness. But what that moment of happiness does is it fades, because the thing that we desired, we have around us for a little while, and it no longer gives us the same kick that it gave us when we first got it. So we start looking for the next thing. You know, how can I get that feeling back, that feeling of happiness back? Get another thing that I want. So we're kind of on this treadmill. We figure that the best kind of happiness we can have is a life where we arrange one thing, one happy thing after the next. We get something we want, and then we get the next thing that we want, we get the next thing that we want, so that we think that's what having a happy life means, to string together these moments of getting what we want. But I think the real brilliance of the Buddha was to point out to us that it's really not so much the getting what we want that brings that happiness. It's the ending of the desire that brings us happiness. The desire itself is this kind of itchy feeling. You know, it's kind of this feel like we're being pulled out of our body. You know, something we want is just like our whole being is motivated towards that thing, like a magnet almost. And that feeling, when we start to pay attention to it in our experience, is unpleasant. That's an unpleasant experience. And so when we get what we want, we get this kind of double hit of some happiness because we've got this thing we wanted, but also this happiness because that feeling of desire is gone. And in the observation of desire, if we bring our understanding, our mindful experience, our mindfulness to our experience of wanting itself, we can see this moment of the disappearance of desire. So being mindful of wanting, being mindful of desire, is a way to understand it. It's a way to see this truth that the Buddha taught, that it's really the ending of desire that brings us happiness. I had a very clear experience of this on one long retreat I was on. It was a 3-month retreat. And I noticed quite a bit of difficulty during walking meditation. I was doing a lot of walking outside and was really noticing this strong desire to look at the people around me. And we'd been instructed to really, they called guarding the sense doors, to keep the attention down. So I was really focused. My eyes were on the ground, you know, about 6 feet in front of me, and I was not looking. I was just following the rules with a very kind of rigid mind. You know, I'm doing this. This is what I'm doing. And I really felt all this incredible desire every time somebody walked by. I felt, you know, I just like, nope, we're not going to look. And this went on for quite a long time. You know, this is a 3-month retreat. So at some point I realized, I was a little slow, I think. It probably took a couple weeks before I realized, oh, desire is what's happening. Maybe I should pay attention to desire as opposed to just trying to block it out, which is what I was doing. I felt like I was trying to put blinders on and block out the wanting. I'm not going to see these people. I'm not going to see them. I'm not going to see them. So to really try to block it out. So I started paying attention to the desire. I started watching it. And I began to notice that the desire started as soon as somebody came into my peripheral vision. And so I was walking along, you know, happily walking. And then suddenly somebody's there in my peripheral vision. The wanting began. The wanting started. And I just noticed what it was like. I mean, it felt like that magnet, that pull. It was very difficult to not look, but to really just, I just felt it. I just noticed that pull towards looking. And so I was just watching it, and it kind of got stronger, you know, the more they came into my field of vision. And they'd, like, you know, walk through and then walk right directly in front of me. And I was just looking down, so I was just noticing, you know, the incredible urge to look up. And then they walk up the stairs and disappear in a door. And the wanting, it disappeared. As soon as the person disappeared, the wanting disappeared. And that was like a revelation. It's like, wow. You know, it was such an amazing experience to actually see that desire disappear. It felt like being released from a vice grip. Now, there's no longer that feeling like I was under the control of something. You know, that the desire often has that feeling of being under the control of. So I watched this for some time, and I kind of got into it because it was so cool to watch it disappear and to feel that release of the desire. And I really saw what the Buddha meant when he said the ending of the wanting is the ending of the suffering. And then at one point, I realized, I was sitting there watching the wanting as somebody was wandering through my field of vision. Again, this is, you know, some days or so later. And I noticed that there was this kind of hanging on to the desire in order to watch it disappear. And it's like, wow, I don't need this. And in that moment, it vanished, even though the person was right there. So it was like the mind had recognized the uselessness, essentially, of this wanting, you know, just all by itself. And from that point on, there was no problem for me with that wanting. So we can pay really careful attention to our desires. Now, what it takes is a commitment, essentially, to turn our attention away from the thing that we want. Turn our attention back and pay attention to what it feels like to be a human being that wants. To really, it's like turning the mirror around. So our attention is just out there so much, you know, that the thing we want, that's where our attention is. We want this new car. We want this experience. Turning the attention around and looking at what does it feel like? What is the experience of wanting? So the second difficult quality of mind, the second covering, is ill will or aversion. Sometimes it's called aversion. And this is one of my favorite ones for me. It's one of the mind states that visited me a lot, still visits me a lot. I think it's probably... We each have our own favorite hindrance, I think, the one that kind of grabs us most easily. And this was and is the one for me. So I've spent a lot of time looking at ill will and aversion. This has to do with the idea that our happiness depends on getting rid of something from our experience, as opposed to our happiness depends on getting something that we want. It depends on getting rid of something that we don't want. It's got many different mind states. It includes states of anger, fear, hostility, contempt, and more subtle ones like resistance, frustration. And again, we're usually very outwardly focused with respect to ill will. We are focused on the thing that we think we need to get rid of, the thing out there. We're focused on trying to arrange our environment to fix some problem. This doesn't mean, now, there's often a misunderstanding or a misinterpretation of this. This doesn't mean that we don't try to change things. I'm not saying that. It's a shift from having to change it to have our happiness depend on it changing. But it doesn't mean that we don't try to change things, particularly where injustice is involved or something we see that's, you know, clearly unethical conduct or, you know, a child being molested. We need to do something about this. So it doesn't mean that we don't act, but it it does mean that we attempt to act from a place of clarity as opposed to from a place of hatred. And it's possible, it's challenging, but it's actually possible to want to change something without hating it. That it can actually be more of a motivation of compassion to want to change it as opposed to hatred. That compassion for essentially all beings, compassion for the person who's perpetrating the issue, the difficulty, if it's racial injustice or molestation, whatever someone is doing, there is a delusion in them that it's a non-understanding in their mind. And rather than hating it, we can act in a way to feel compassion for the person to try to prevent them from harming themselves and others. So I really just want to make that clear, that I'm not saying, when I'm saying, you know, that we want to get rid of things and turn and look inward, that it doesn't mean that we're not trying to change things. But it's extremely useful to turn inwards and pay attention to the aversion. And in that place of paying attention to the aversion, we can learn something, potentially stilling our reactivity and probably coming to a place of more clarity about a skillful action. When we're acting out of reactivity, we don't have the clarity to know or to operate skillfully often. So this turning inwards gives us this initial understanding of our own reactivity and how we're actually harming ourselves with that reactivity. This state of ill will is likened in the Buddhist texts of picking up a coal, a hot coal, to throw at somebody in order to hurt them. And if you have hit your target, you will in fact hurt them, but you have burned yourself first through the picking up of the coal. So the state of aversion is it's a very hot, burning kind of state. So turning our attention inward, what does it feel like to experience this? This can be difficult because it is such an unpleasant experience. It's hard to believe, actually, that it's worth our time to pay attention to it in this way. It seems to make much more sense to try to figure out how to get rid of it. But this turning inward allows these states, the state of aversion, to essentially live its life, to all of these hindrances have a life. They're born, they last for a time, and then they disappear. And we can begin to see that these states have conditions that cause them and bring them together, and then conditions that take them apart. So beginning to observe, what is it that triggers this aversion? Often in states, in our meditation, it's something like a pain in our body triggers aversion, or a thought of something that we've forgotten to do, and we spend our time worrying about, did I turn the oven off? You know, so we end up in these states of agitation and aversion to our experience. So part of it is to turn our experience back and look at the agitation, look at the aversion itself, and notice what it feels like. Notice that it's different from the thing that We are averse to. There's so often they get tied up, especially with something like pain. We think that there's no way to experience the pain without experiencing the aversion to it as well. But they're actually different things. And we can see when we start to pay attention that the pain can get increased when we are experiencing aversion with it. The pain itself is unpleasant, and the aversion is another unpleasant experience. So we're adding an unpleasant experience on top of an already unpleasant experience, which makes things worse. So bringing our attention to the aversion can begin to show us this, that this is a reactivity that's going on, that the aversion is a reactivity to our experience. I had a really an experience pretty early in my practice that was so helpful in seeing this distinction between the thing that I was reacting to and the reactivity. I had broken up with a boyfriend at one point and was experiencing incredible. He had broken up with me, actually. I was experiencing incredible amount of anger around this breakup. So I'd been observing my anger quite a lot, paying a lot of attention to it. And several months of paying attention to this anger, noticing really clearly how unpleasant it was, spending a lot of time in the space of, wow, this is anger. Boy, this is, what do I do with this? This is really unpleasant. And sometimes it can feel that way. You know, what do I do with this? Actually, simply the recognition of it is really helpful. Just recognizing what the state is, naming it, knowing it, this is anger. And that's about all I was able to do with this anger. It was kind of an overwhelming experience for me. So I had been paying attention to this anger and noticing really how unpleasant it was. It did feel like that hot coal. And this was really, really clearly pointed out to me how much like this was a hot coal, because the person that I was angry with was 7,000 miles away. And I could tell I had this belief that somehow this anger would hurt him, but it was pretty clear it wasn't doing a thing to him because he was 7,000 miles away. So I began to really notice the suffering in my experience around this anger, how I was suffering, how it was unhelpful for me to feel this anger. And so I'd been paying attention to that for quite some time. And one day, I was in my kitchen, and everything was fine. Nothing was particularly going on. And I cut an apple. I was cutting an apple, and I noticed a memory of being with my ex-boyfriend in a fruit stand. And I hadn't had the experience of my ex-boyfriend coming into my mind without anger immediately arising. But I noticed in that moment that I wasn't yet angry. I was pretty mindful, and I saw the thought. I saw that it had come from cutting the apple, that there was a connection, a link between the cutting the apple and the thought. And I saw that I wasn't yet angry, that there wasn't yet anger in my mind. But I did see this. It felt like a freight train of desire almost to get angry. It's like this, yeah, I'm going to jump on this thought and think more thoughts to get angry. So there was this movement of anger, like this impulsion towards anger. I also saw that. I saw that movement. And it's like, whoa, I know what's going to happen if I go there. You know, I had really felt what that anger had felt like. And all of this is kind of not my doing. It was more just the mind recognizing these things. This recognizing the memory, recognizing that I wasn't angry, recognizing that impulsion towards anger. That was just happening because the mind was paying attention. And in that simple paying attention, the mind also let go of the movement towards anger. It was like letting go of a hot pot from a stove. Kind of like the body just going, yeah, I know what that's about. You know, I'm not going to go there because I know I'm going to get burned. And the mind didn't get angry. I was shocked. I stood there for a few minutes waiting to get angry because I just assumed there was no way that this person could come into my mind and I would not get angry. And that moment, that was actually the moment, it was early in my practice, within the first few months of my practice, that I had this experience. And that was the one that showed me the power of mindfulness. It's like, that's the one that hooked me on this practice right then and there. I could hardly believe the power that mindfulness had to reveal that subtle link between a memory and a reaction, and could cut in and break that chain. This is possible with our mindfulness practice when we pay attention to our experience as opposed to focusing outward on the thing that we're angry with. Then there's sloth and torpor, which is something a lot of you have been experiencing, at least from the interviews. It appears that a lot of you have been experiencing sloth and torpor. This is sloth is the state of dullness of mind, and torpor refers to sleepiness. So these states are very, very common on retreat. Particularly early in the practice, early in a retreat, and then again at particular times of day, often we find that these states just descend. Sloth can feel like a dullness, a fogginess, like we just can't see anything. You know, it's just like everything feels sticky and gooey. And with torpor, we're just like so sleepy we can't function. So working with this. Prime thing is to recognize it so that you can name it or note it. You know, really just bring it to your attention. This is what's happening. With sleepiness, sometimes we have to acknowledge that we actually need sleep. And especially early in a retreat, we're sleep-deprived culture. So sometimes we just need some rest, especially early in a retreat. But there are often times, too, when the mind just gets kind of dull. And sometimes it has to do with the developing concentration. The mind, the concentration develops, and the energy isn't quite strong enough. And so the mind gets a little bit dull and foggy, even though it's actually getting a little more concentrated. So working with this, with sleepiness, there's some just very basic things. You know, opening your eyes, I talked about a few of these, standing up. Pinching your ears really hard. You can take a more brisk walk. There's some things that you can do to bring a little bit of energy into the mind. You can also bring your attention mindfully to it. I don't remember if I mentioned this in the hall this morning, but I have mentioned it in some of the interviews about noticing the pleasantness, noticing how pleasant it is actually to be sleepy. The feelings can just kind of descend and be very, very... If we're not resisting sleepiness, if we're resisting sleepiness, the feelings are really unpleasant. If we're not resisting it, it's very pleasant. So we can use that pleasantness to engage the mind in a little bit of interest because it generally likes paying attention to things that are pleasant. So bringing some attention to the actual experience of sleepiness. I did this on one retreat, and I kind of just rode the sleepiness over and over again. I would watch this state of real pleasantness descend, and then the moment before I was going to drop, I could feel it. I could feel the mind just getting ready to fall asleep. And I would like sit up a little bit straighter, and I'd get this rush of energy, and then I'd relax and just do it all over again. So staying mindful and just really riding, it felt like riding waves of pleasantness, to ride the sleepiness like that. With torpor, with dullness of mind, one of the tricks for me with dullness of mind is to begin to recognize that you can know dullness of mind. The mind feels dull, so it feels like it can't know anything. It feels foggy, so it feels like it can't see anything. But the mind can clearly know its dullness. It's kind of like a mirror. that perfectly reflects what it sees. And when the mirror is foggy, you can't see the landscape or you can't see the person in front of the mirror. But you know, actually, the mirror is perfectly reflecting every drop of water on that mirror. And the mind functions that way. The mind can perfectly know fogginess. So there's a clarity of knowing. Mindfulness can have a kind of clarity to it. And if we can kind of shift our emphasis from the fact that we can't see the objects anymore, it's like, you know, when the mind is dull like that, it's hard to actually get our experience on any particular thing because the mind has got that layer of fog on it. But the mind can know that layer of fog completely, just like the mirror reflects it completely. And when we have that shift of emphasis to the knowing, it's suddenly like, oh, there's clear. It's clear. It's clear that the mind is foggy. It's kind of like looking out of a window where there's a lot of fog. You know, you can't see the trees, you can't see the road, but you know the eye is functioning. It's just looking at fogginess. So that's, for me, that's been a really helpful tool in looking at dullness of mind. Then there is restlessness and remorse. These are often related to, or restlessness is related to an excess of energy, and there can be physical restlessness as well as mental restlessness. The physical restlessness often has this feeling of like you can't sit still, like they're jumping beans under your skin. It's just like it's torture almost to sit still. Something that is helpful with that is really to allow the mind to get as broad as possible. Really let the feeling of restlessness get as big as it wants to. It doesn't have to stay contained in your body. Let the whole of the zendo hold the restlessness. Let the mind get really big. Don't try to get detailed and precise about paying attention to restless sensations. Just let the mind get really big. Sometimes it helps to stand or to put your legs up in the rest posture, which is this posture that he's sitting in, to allow the body a little bit of a break. So mental restlessness has to do with the mind just like not being able to land on anything. It just goes to that thing and that thing and that thing and that thing, and it just a lot of thoughts often spinning out with a restless mind. Often this has to do with an emotion that is underlying this restless mind. So check in. If the mind is just kind of scanning around and not able to stay still, a lot of thoughts in the mind, check in and see if there's an emotion underneath that restless mind. Remorse has to do with a kind of an unsettledness of regret of something, an action untaken or something done that we wished we hadn't done. And a lot of remorse, the difficulty around remorse is that we go into our thoughts trying to figure out how to change the past. How can we not have done that thing? Or how could we have done that thing that we wished we had done? So a lot, if you can actually notice that that's what's happening, you can actually see the futility of it. You know, it's like wanting to change what we can't change, impossible to change. So bringing the attention to the remorse and recognizing actually, it's actually skillful to recognize, yes, when I made that action, perhaps it was an unskillful action. Often remorse comes around, you know, something unskillful we've done. You know, saying something to a friend we wished we hadn't said. And part of the working with remorse is allowing it in that, yes, when I have done something unskillful, it feels like this. And believe it or not, that is actually a way through the remorse. That what we try to do is, with the thinking, we try to figure out how to change it. We can't change it. but we can experience it. We may at some point realize in the feeling of that remorse that there is an action that needs to be taken, an apology that needs to be made. And it's so much easier once we recognize it and to just make those amends. So that really getting in and yes, this is what it feels like. This is what it feels like to have acted unskillfully. The last of the five hindrances is doubt. And this is one of the most difficult of the hindrances because it masquerades, we're actually nowhere in the vicinity of our experience when we're experiencing doubt. We're so far gone that we don't even know we're experiencing doubt. And it often masquerades as something we think is kind of wise. So Joseph Goldstein actually likes to say that doubt often masquerades as wisdom. For instance, we can have doubt about a lot of things, like the teachings the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago. How can this possibly apply to me in this day and age? We might have doubt about the teachers. What can they know? Maybe I should find a better teacher. I know if I had a really good teacher, I'd be enlightened like that. We have doubts about ourselves to do the practice. You know, I can't do this. Everybody else seems to be able to do it, but I can only stay with half a breath before my mind is wandering off. Obviously, I should do some other practice. Sometimes doubt manifests as, which practice should I do now? You know, I've learned about loving kindness, and I've learned about opening to all experience and paying attention to the breath. Let's see, what am I feeling right now? Maybe I should do a little loving kindness. And maybe I should really pay attention to my breath. No, what I really should pay attention to is that anger. And we get kind of caught in this, what should I do? So if you find yourself thinking thoughts, it's really helpful to know the stories of doubt. If you find yourself thinking thoughts about the practice, about what to do in the practice, about why I can't do the practice, it's probably doubt. So noticing that doubt exists is the main antidote to doubt. Because once it's seen, it can't operate in that kind of undercover. It operates undercover a lot. You know, that it really depends on delusion to function. Doubt depends completely on delusion to function. So once it's seen, so recognizing the stories of doubt is a key to knowing that doubt is happening. So I really want to mostly encourage you to take an interest in paying attention to these difficult mind states. Noticing when they're there, especially noticing them, being able to recognize them is more than half the process. More than half the process is just noticing, yeah, this is anger. This is ill will. This is doubt. Once that happens, we have the opportunity to come in and pay attention. And as I mentioned earlier, we often think that they are in the way. I mean, they are called the hindrances, so we figure they're in the way. But when we bring this kind of attention to them, they actually are the path. When they are coming up, they are our path. Mindfulness of what is happening right now is always the path. And if that is anger, that is the place that we can cultivate freedom. We can cultivate freedom from being caught by the habitual pattern of anger and being able to have choice about how we respond to it, as opposed to being driven by our automatic reactivity to it, itself being a form of automatic reactivity. So this is not a lesser practice, actually, paying attention to the hindrances. It doesn't matter what we're mindful of. It just really doesn't matter. In terms of cultivating mindfulness and cultivating the clear seeing of experience, cultivating the seeing that things are impermanent, that they're not satisfactory as a lasting source of happiness, that they're not, that they're just created by causes and conditions. They can't really be mine. Anything in our experience can see. We can see these characteristics with anything. We can see the impermanence of anger. We can see the unsatisfactory nature of desire. And this is clear seeing. These are the kind of insights that lead to complete freedom of mind. And it doesn't take getting rid of all of these things. It takes being able to witness them. Understand them, as the Buddha said. Understand suffering. That is, when we understand suffering in this way, we are also on the path to freedom from suffering. Let's just sit for a moment.